Part 020. Monday was much like the previous one. Mabel did laundry and I worked on the plots. There were onions to split and replant. Some tomato plants to take from seeding pots and plant out. For the tomatoes, I was impressed how Mabel, or maybe it was Peter or even someone earlier, had chosen a plot with some raspberry and blackcurrants around it which would provide some shelter, and there was even a bit of old drystone wall. I wondered how we'd support the plants once the fruit started to come. Strange, I'd never been an outdoor person before. Somehow, I was beginning to feel I didn't want to work indoors again. That might, of course, change if the weather were bad. At lunch, I asked Mabel directly how will we support the tomatoes. I've seen people use wire cages, but I'm sure they're too expensive and hard to get now. We'll try to get some sticks when trees are pruned, or else from the clump of bamboo, but I try to be sparing with that because it's so useful. And we've some left over from last year. We tie them up with some sisal twine, or sometimes use some twisted straw or bits of wire. Oh, yes. I saw some old wooden boxes in the byre with odds and ends. Good job I didn't toss them. We should bring the boxes in and try to tidy things so we can find the things we want. Never enough time, of course. Perhaps while listening to the wireless of an evening, I suggested. Your knitting'll suffer, Mabel laughed. There was, of course, plenty to keep me busy. Tuesday we took the wheelbarrows and some rope and got the rusty and broken tools from George's shop. He put in a pair of wire brushes and asked if Mabel had some sand, which she did in a big bin beside the one where I put the weeds for the rabbits. He also asked about oil, and I mentioned the motor oil. Good. And I presume you know how to use it. Yes. I think so. When we've got a tool cleaned up, we rub on the oil. And don't forget to leave the oily rag spread out and away from anywhere where spontaneous combustion will start a fire. I didn't know about that, and asked what he meant. Somehow oily rags could oxidize slowly, and if there wasn't good ventilation and cooling, eventually get hot enough to ignite. Worth keeping an eye out for that. We had enough fires at the moment. Apparently the same thing could happen to haystacks if they got wet inside. We got back to the farm and put the tools on the makeshift table that I'd set up from the old door and the sawhorses. As and when I had some time, I'd start working on the tools. There was, however, a new pair of secateurs which we put on a hook in the tool closet. And I'd made Mabel smile when I got a pair of leatherwork gloves and a new pruning knife that I had paid for and said I wanted for myself. Actually, we didn't do much with the new tools, as we called them, except lay them out and agree we'd work on them when we could, likely in the byre on days when the weather told us it wasn't worth getting soaked on the plots. I did move the turpentine can of oil and an old paint tin full of sand out to the byre just in case. But today we were working outside. A bit of weeding. Some replanting. Checking the radishes, a few were ready to try for tea, along with some young lettuces, but not much yet set for harvesting. We decided to pick our sample tomorrow rather than today. We could see some cucumbers were going to set. Root vegetables were showing their tops, but we daren't yet check under the surface in the new plots, but there were some planted late last year that possibly could be pulled. In the afternoon, I was planting some beans while Mabel sprayed some fruit trees to stop some pest or other. She had a tank with a pump that led to a hose with a long wand at the end. She came by where I was planting and said, "You're doing a nice job there, Mary." My plot was by a pond that was near the road. I recalled Mabel saying she and Peter had arranged to have this pond dug in 1939. I asked, "Why did you have the pond dug, and why here?" After Munich, Peter figured there'd be a war, and out here there's no fire hydrants. We've also had a couple of years where things got a bit dry later in the season, so a pond made sense. We had it dug with a mechanical digger, then got some clay to line it so the water wouldn't seep away. And we've got some of the pathways with tiles underneath, though just a few near the pond. That way rain goes into the pond. If it gets full, you see there's an overflow into the ditch by the road. and we put it near the road so the firemen could get at it easily if we or our neighbors have a fire. But it's useful to be able to dip a bucket or the watering can in the pond and not have to go back to the house or the tap in the yard when you need some water for the plants. No ducks? I asked. We'd talked about them, but not got around to it. I've seen a few wild ones swim on the pond. Since the plots are close, there's not good cover for nests. I don't know what mischievous demon pushed me to think of having duck houses, but the idea came into my head, and I said, what if I tried to build a nest house or two for them and we got a few? The pond is there, so why not give it a try? I think the Jenkins have ducks down the road. Might take a look at their arrangements. Part 021. When Mabel went back to spraying, she'd come past me on her way to refill the tank. I thought about how nice it was to be told I was doing a good job. At my wage clerk's job, I got occasional thank yous but rarely a compliment. Mabel, however, made me feel competent and welcome. Not like William. But I was beginning to realize that I was competent at lots of things. And I might be still a danger to myself and others on a bicycle just yet, but soon I'd be able to ride, and ride well. I could feel it in my bones. William's sneers and demeaning comments were unjustified and intended to diminish me, to make me bend to his will. Well, that was over, mister. When I finished the beans, I went back to the house and washed up. Tonight I was going to be cook. Mabel said she'd never cooked fish, so I'd said I could do it. I'd got some haddock fillets at a fishmonger. They weren't rationed, though you usually had to queue up and hope for decent fish. With seafarers going into the Navy and boats being requisitioned for Dunkirk or patrol use, some trawlers were being used as convoy rescue boats, the fish supply was uncertain. I'd heard talk that the government only rationed things they could ensure would be delivered, and the rest was catch as catch can. Since fats were on rations, I decided to bake the fillets with a coat of breadcrumbs and herbs. I also put some potatoes in the oven with a bit of milk in a fashion that I'd seen in a magazine recently described as American scalloped potatoes. Not much known in England, but it meant the heat of the oven got used efficiently. I also put in some apples with some porridge oats and a spoon of honey to make a sort of apple crisp. For vegetable, we had some turnip and carrots. Not terribly exciting, but hopefully it would do. Moreover, I packed everything into the oven to cook. As it turned out, everyone ate all that I put in front of them. There wasn't a huge wave of enthusiasm, but the comments of Mabel and the children were that it was fine, especially the baked apple crisp. Delia liked the potatoes. Oliver asked why they'd never had fish done this way before, which I took to mean he liked it. I counted that as another vote for the fish. It's nice to be able to get something with protein that isn't on rations, Mabel said. And we're far enough from the center of town that fish and chips aren't really an option for us. I think we can add fish, well haddock anyway, to our meal rota. From my perspective, the turnip and carrots were a bit dull, I said. Oliver nodded, as did Delia. We'd want to think of livelier vegetables to complement the fish. Pimentos, would they grow here, and were they even known to the Gaffneys? Part 022. The following weekend was a very dismal one as the news of the loss of HMS Hood was announced. So many young men lost. Just 3 survivors out of 1,500 sailors. A few days later, we learned that Bismarck was sunk too. A brutal revenge. Also on the Sunday, we had a telephone call from Mabel's parents. Well, the call actually went to Maud, who then telephoned the farm. Just after midnight, a Dornier had dropped a stick of bombs on Mudford Avenue in Yeovil, which apparently was where the parents of the sisters lived. Bombing information was generally hushed up so the Germans wouldn't know if they'd hit their targets or not, but the gossip mill would share the news locally, even as far away as Taunton was from Yeovil. The Taylors, that was the maiden name of the sisters, were all right, except their house was one of 115 damaged. However, 8 houses were completely destroyed in the raid, 5 people killed and 7 injured. Henry Taylor was going to stay in Yeovil to arrange repairs as best he could, but Matilda was going to come to Taunton. Maud said she had room. The war news affected our mood, but not the pattern of work. Some of the spring produce was coming on now, and we harvested some radishes and lettuces, a bit of early spinach, and dug up some of their old swedes. From a lean-to shed behind the chicken coop, Mabel produced some wooden flats of the same type I'd found in the byre, and we packed these up. Mr. Jessop, a neighbour with a donkey and cart, came by and took these to town. His fee, half a dozen eggs. Jessop apparently had a number of arrangements like this and ate well on zero cash income. He did, of course, get cash for transporting other goods for people all over the Taunton area, and was a local institution. He always had a wave for me, and I always waved back, if I hadn't waved first. Produce from the farm apparently went to 3 Taunton greengrocers and 2 in Ilminster. One of the Ilminster shops had a van and picked up things in Taunton to take for several Ilminster merchants besides himself. There was not apparently enough business for each to fetch their orders, and it made sense to avoid unnecessary costs. Moreover, the Ministry of Food pushed hard to minimize how far food was transported. Bakers were going to have to get their flour from the nearest mill, for example. I'd done my first cycle ride off the farm to the Jenkins and had roughly measured the duck houses. From some of the odds and ends of lumber in the byre, I fashioned a pair of rather odd-looking but workable huts, which Oliver and I mounted on short posts so their floors would be dry. I made sure there was good drainage of the floors. Ducks would no doubt leave their droppings. Mabel apparently found someone to sell us a pair of Muscovy ducks and a couple of pairs of call ducks. The latter were apparently good at getting slugs. We wondered if foxes would be a problem, but decided to leave our ducks to range. Once they'd got themselves installed, they seemed to be happy to guard their domain, sometimes noisily. Eventually they had ducklings and increased our livestock, and I built a couple more duck houses. The days came and went. I realized that I'd found a contentment. My muscles might ache sometimes, but my days were peaceful and I found them rewarding, even when it was raining. Quite often Reggie would come near where I was working and lie down and watch me, but not in a suspicious way. I think he liked my company, and I must say, I liked him there. Every so often, I'd give him a pat and his tail would wag. I'd never had any pets, so this interaction with an animal was new to me. By the end of May, I was riding a bicycle competently, and could swing my leg over the saddle with aplomb. My legs were long enough that I could stand on the balls of my feet and not have the crossbar threatening to sexually molest me. The bicycle gave me an opportunity to explore the area more widely, and I grasped this chance enthusiastically. On May 31st, Mabel and the children went to see one of Mabel's friends who lived with her family in Ilminster. I decided to go out on my bike, I thought of it as mine now anyway, and explore the area. I locked up the house and got out my bike from the byre and shut the door. We hadn't done anything yet about getting it a lock too. Reggie looked at me in a way that suggested he wanted to come with me. Perhaps another time. I didn't want to have him get lost. Stay, Reggie. Look after the chickens. I didn't really have a destination, and first rode into Taunton and past the station, then out the other side and round some lanes back to the east of town. About 12:30 I found myself outside a very old church, it turned out to be 13th century, in Stoke St. Mary. And round the corner was the Half Moon Inn. Just what I needed, first for a lavatory, then for some refreshment. Inside it wasn't crowded, as a number of patrons were sitting outside. Though it wasn't that warm, it was dry and the sun was intermittently shining, and that had got me outside on the bike. However, I now wanted to be warm, and I wanted a comfortable chair. I ordered a half pint of cider and a Cornish pasty and found a nice chair that was near a window. There was a bench and table under the window, and the chair was a seeming afterthought, but had a cushioned seat and back on a generous wooden frame. A voice said, "So you found a place to sleep, and perhaps a job." The owner of the voice was a sandy-haired man of about my own age, wearing a nice home-knitted pullover.
I don't.
The policeman at the station when you arrived after being bombed out in London. The cheek seems better.
Oh,
yes. I didn't recognize you. Without my uniform. An occupational hazard of the bobby on the beat. A doctor friend of mine made the mistake of saying he didn't recognize a patient with her clothes on, meaning with her street clothes on. He'd only known her in hospital in her nightdress. I laughed, then asked, "But how did you recognize me?" I saw you ride in, then I noticed the repair to your trousers, which somehow I'd put to memory when I saw you at the station. By the way, my name is Jack Morrison. Mary. Mary Smith. I was talking to the landlord, but he has other customers now. Mind if I join you? I nodded. He continued, "Let me retrieve my pint. I've been out for a walk to get some air. Had a late shift last night, but did get in 6 hours of sleep." It occurred to me that chatting with a policeman could be a risk, given my false identity. On the other hand, getting to know a constable as well as other people in the community would be what Mary Smith should do as someone who planned to be here. "Tell me how you got on with the WI that Sunday," Jack prompted. I related my story. I didn't have to tell any lies, and I could enthuse over my work and the dog Reggie and the children and the food. I realized that the details I was including, all of them real, provided substance to the hollow shell that had been me. The gradually filling shell that was now Mary Smith. Jack said Mabel Gaffney's had a tough year. There was a fellow named Joe Short supposed to do the heavy work when Peter joined up. George Brown came and had a quiet word that Mabel thought stuff was going missing, and practically the next day we had a message from Bournemouth that some wooden flats for produce were found at a hotel where some wealthy Londoners were doing a bunk from the Blitz, and they were marked as from Gaffney's farm. Wasn't too hard to put two and two together, but Short had scarpered.
Yes.
Mabel told me. Guess it helped that you're local, Jack? You didn't rush in and accuse Mabel, like might happen where people don't know each other. I'm from Somerset, but my family actually lives over near Wells. Not right in Wells, but sort of like Stoke St. Mary here is to Taunton. It'd be a good deal easier if I was assigned there, but I think the constabulary likes to avoid having us working where our families live. Even if everything is on the up and up, there can be gossip about the copper letting his nearest and dearest get away with something. So you have lodgings near here?
Yes.
A Mrs. Green up the road. Widow with grown daughters, so she had a couple of rooms, and two of us bobbies live there. Be nice if she was a better cook. I imagine things aren't bad with Mrs. Gaffney. They've a nice little place there, and should have plenty of fresh veg, and you mentioned chickens and rabbits.
Yes.
The food is good. But I like Mabel and the children a lot. They've made me feel very welcome and a part of the place. I find that more important than the food. But I suppose good food helps. Did you leave anyone behind in London?
Oops.
Did Jack guess about William?
No. It was... oh.
He's wondering if there's a boyfriend. I was about to smile, but realized I should use Joan Smith's history in case anyone checked. The use of her middle name could be explained away as wanting a new start, but better to keep straight the bits of her history that I could use. Jack was beginning to look awkward with my silence. I said simply he didn't come back from Dunkirk. Missing, believed dead. My delay in responding was explicable by the what I said. Sorry. Rather put my foot in my mouth.
No.
Don't be sorry about asking. I'll accept condolences, but I'm flattered that you asked. And, truthfully, if he'd come back I doubt we'd have continued going out together. I was starting to feel really awkward, because, well, you know, I didn't want to write one of those awful letters when he was at the front. But I did want him as a friend, a long-term friend, even if I wasn't thinking of a wedding.
Yes.
It's not easy to write things like that when someone's out serving. There was a bit of silence, Then I said, how about you? Had a couple of girlfriends.
Oh. No.
Not at the same time. Over in Wells, but nothing serious. I've been working to get ahead in the force, and not sure yet where I'm headed. At the moment, I'm registered to get called up, but there's nobody able to come out of retirement to replace me, so I'm in limbo. Police are needed these days to keep order, especially when there's damage and scavengers about, trying to loot people's stuff. Feel a bit like a coward here in Taunton, but the bomb the other night at least showed we're part of the war.
Were you there?
A few minutes after. There was fortunately nobody hurt, though we had to get a kiddie out of a second-story bedroom that was all opened up like a doll's house, with the stairs gone. I was about to go up a ladder when the fire brigade arrived, so I was mostly trying to get people who were just gawking to go home and let the poor people whose property was damaged get things a bit organized. That's the policeman's job these days, I'd guess. More so than chasing villains.
True.
Though we know there's quite a bit of crime, black market, burglaries, some assaults, and the blackout makes a lot of that easier. Even murders are up. You'd think there was enough going on, wouldn't you?
Hadn't thought about that much.
And there's apparently a lot more domestics, what with the disruption to regular life. Very awkward, as generally the law considers all that private, but some men are savages. I bit my tongue. Much as I'd love to dive in, that topic would be off limits for me. I should probably get back. Reggie, the dog, will be wondering where we all are, and we don't tie him up so he can chase off foxes or other vermin.
Jack looked flustered. He said, pity you have to go. I was enjoying our conversation.
So was I said. Jack smiled broadly. You know there's Castle Neroche near here, well, easy bike ride though uphill to the site, that was Iron Age then a Norman castle. Perhaps you'd like to ride there one day.
That would be nice, I replied, and genuinely meant it.
I'll drop by Gaffney's small holding when I've confirmed my work rota and see when we might give it a try, assuming the weather cooperates.
And Mr. Hitler.
I put on my bicycle clips and Jack waved me off. He seemed nice, but then William had seemed nice too. On the other hand, Jack didn't seem to talk down to me. It occurred to me that I could enjoy Jack's company, but what would happen if he got serious? On the one hand, William's wife was presumed dead. I was a bit curious as to whether a death certificate had been issued. And Mary Smith was, in the technical parlance, a spinster. Perhaps take things slowly. Today was just a chance conversation in a pub. A nice conversation. A nice man. A nice man who might get called up when there was a replacement policeman. Better be careful. By the time I'd reached the farm, I'd decided that Leonard would be a good excuse to accept casual friendship with Jack but avoid getting serious in any hurry. I could give myself time to decide what options were open to me. Part 023. It turned out that it wasn't until Midsummer's Day, a Saturday, that Jack and I were able to cycle to Castle Neroche. In the meantime, I was busy with both my regular work on the farm and other small adventures. June 1st, as you may know, the government put in rationing of clothes. When we heard that on the wireless, Mabel said, good thing you bought what you did, Mary. It'll be tricky to get much now without a lot of fuss.
Yes.
I'm very glad I got what I did. And, as you know, I went and got quite a bit of extra from different second-hand shops. Mostly boys' or men's stuff to use for work clothes. In fact, in the way of women's clothing, I've got only my skirt and blouse and that one dress that needs altering. And just one pair of Lyle stockings. Don't suppose we'll see any silk or nylon for a bit. And I've got just two brassieres. You and I can do without those, given we're not over buxom, Mabel noted. And you remember I made you get those boys' vests? Well, besides adding a bit of warmth on a cold day, you can get away with one of those to, you know, avoid bouncing around too much.
I laughed. Yes, good idea. And I'm well set for trousers, with 4 pairs now. 5 if I can get that ripped pair sorted out. And I've a half dozen shirts once I get them fixed and sized. And 2 good jumpers. That sailing jacket you found all smelly in the back of that jumble shop has cleaned up all right. A bit big on me, but with the tear fixed using the puncture kit, I should be able to be out in the rain and keep myself dry. Though I do need a hat that won't drain down my neck. Maybe worth buying a hat like they're giving the land girls. Sort of a cowboy hat with a wide brim. We'll look for one when we go into town. Or you might look for an old men's hat. Part 024. There was a bit of rain one night later in the week. In the morning, Mabel said, "We've got a leak in the roof." Delia's pointed out a spot on the ceiling. After breakfast, we went up into the attic. There was a hatch in the ceiling, with a ladder I hadn't noticed lying along the wall of the upstairs landing that hooked over the sill. There was a partial floor in the attic and we could walk around carefully. Some things were stored up there. Before Mabel brought up the lamp, I poked my head into the space and could see a gap in the slates. "There are 1 or 2 slates over there that have come loose," I said. "Bother. While someone can work inside to fasten the wire, the slates need to be pushed into place on the outside, which means going up on a ladder. Let's take a look about first. No sense in having to get up there more than once," I said. As we looked around, I spotted a 3-foot by 4-foot frame. It had a backboard, but no picture or glass. I said, "Mabel, if we put cardboard in this frame, it could be used as a pinboard to put up lists of things we need to do." "You're right, Mary. Let's bring it down." We did, raising clouds of dust in the process. We should have wiped it off first. When we had it in the kitchen, Mabel pointed to a space on a wall away from the range. "I think it'll go there. We'll talk over tea how to use it. I've an idea that we should ask the children about." We'd found just one place where the slates were not in place properly, so I went to the buyer and took out the ladders and brought them over to the house. "Mabel, several of the rungs in the ladders are a bit loose. I think we need to make them secure." Peter said he meant to put in new wedges. He'd spent some time making some wedges. "Oh yes. They're under the stairs." She found a box with some wedgies and a can that claimed to be wood glue. I cleaned out the loose rung ends as well as I could and we put some glue in the space where the wedge would go. "Mabel, I suspect that putting in the wedge too heavily could split the uprights." "Yes. Better just tap in the wedge until the rung is solid." I tapped very, very gently and got the wedgies mostly in. When the glue was truly set, I should file and sand off the extra bits of the wedgies. Where did I hear someone talk about doing that? Around the farm, it almost seemed like there was a ghost talking in my ear about how to do things. I remembered the ropes in the byre and went and got the longest one. I asked Mabel to get some twine and an old sock. "What do you want them for?" she asked. "If we put some sand in the sock and tie it to the twine, we can throw it over the roof, then pull a rope over. One end of the rope can be tied to the top of the ladder and the other secured somewhere on the far side of the house. Then that ladder can lie on the roof more securely." "That makes sense, but you'll also notice that one ladder has a sort of hook arrangement at one end. Like an L with the top rung at the vertex of the L and the arms too long to go beyond the second rung. You push the ladder up with one arm of the L under the ladder. When you get it beyond the top of the roof, it drops and the ladder gets hooked on the roof. When you're done, you push the ladder up and haul on that string to bring the arm of the L back. Notice the sort of wedge ends of the arm to help it back over the ridge of the roof. Still, it will be a good idea to secure the ladder up to the roof. And it may help to get the second ladder up there. Peter just carried it up with one hand, but I doubt either of us are strong enough and I'm terrified of heights. It took us 3 tries to get the sock over the rooftop, but we were soon in business. From somewhere, Mabel produced a wooden yoke that fastened across the top of the ladder at a point just above the roofline and would rest on the tiles to spread the weight and avoid pressing on the gutters. Interesting. Peter must have had to do this before. As I thought this, Mabel said Peter didn't like having to wait for the builder to come and fix the slates. We've had to do this before, but not in this location. We laid both ladders down with the bottom ends in position near the house, then one of us kept that end from moving as the other walked the ladder up to the vertical and set it against the house. I'd tied the loose end of a rope to the top of the ladder that was going to lead up to the roof. The other end of the rope was tied to the string we'd tossed over top of the roof. When the ladder was where we wanted it, I gradually pulled the string, then the rope, and when it was taut enough, I tied the end of the rope to a metal pipe Mabel drove into the ground at an angle. Mabel was, as she said, scared of heights, so going up the ladder would be my job. I'm no daredevil, but I made my way up the ladder to roof level, while Mabel steadied the ladder, though the yoke at the top was a big help. We'd positioned the second ladder against the roof beside the ladder to get up to the roof. But once I was up at roof height, how was I going to haul up to ladder to be laid against the slates? I didn't want to let go both hands from the ladder I was on. Mabel realized the difficulty at the same moment I did. From my position at the top of the ladder, I asked, how did Peter get the other ladder up? I think he just carried it up in one arm, then hooked his other arm round the ladder he was on to slide the roof ladder up one rung at a time. I'm sure I'm not strong enough to do that, but I've an idea. I descended and retrieved the sock and string. Mabel got the sand-filled sock over the roof in 1 try. She had a good throwing arm. We tied a rope to the top of the ladder and then walked it to vertical. I was about to send Mabel to the other side of the house to pull to help get the ladder up the roof, when I realized a problem. If you are pulling as I lift, it's going to pull the ladder hard against the gutter and we won't make progress. Bother. But without some assistance, how are you going to lift the ladder and position it? If we attach the rope to the middle of the ladder, you can pull while I lift it up. We should do about 1 foot at a time on my shout. When we get the middle of the ladder to the edge of the roof will be a bit tricky as it could come over too fast, so I'll yell easy and you can just take the weight and I'll do the maneuvering. Then when it's flat on the roof more or less, we can haul and push it up. That description probably minimizes the push and shove needed to get the ladder up, but we managed, and I was able to carefully transfer to the roof ladder once it was secure. We made sure both ladders were tied off. I gained a lot of respect for the auxiliary fire service that day. The actual repair of the slate, one had come adrift and smashed on the yard and had to be replaced with one from the pile in the byre, wasn't that difficult. We had had the foresight to lean a slate against the roof in the gutter, and I had some copper wire in my pocket. Lying on the roof ladder, I pushed the slate into position after looping wire through the holes, and Mabel, who had gone inside the attic, pulled the wire tight and somehow fastened it to slats supporting the tiles. I checked adjacent slates and they seemed all right. Now I had to get down. I won't hide the fact that this really terrified me. I eased down to the gutter. I shifted as far as I could on the roof ladder towards the ladder which would get me down. By now Mabel was at the bottom of that ladder, steadying it and watching me, and telling me where my foot was relative to a rung. Then I very, very carefully moved one hand to the top of the main ladder and then 1 foot to the highest rung below the gutter. Gently I transferred my weight from one ladder to the other. My foot on the main ladder was, unfortunately, too close to the side to fit my other foot, so I eased the free foot onto the next rung down. It was a bit of a stretch, but then I could adjust my position so I was chest height to the gutter. I untied the string that was fastened to the L and moved it close to me, in fact, hanging over the edge of the gutter. I didn't want it disappearing out of reach when we shifted the roof ladder. Go round and take hold of the rope for the roof ladder, I called out to Mabel, and she disappeared round the side of the house. In a while I heard her call ready. I'm going to push up now if you can pull gently. The roof ladder slid up the roof a foot or so. Mabel called, "I think it's clear. You can try the string now." "Have you got the weight of the ladder?" I shouted. "Yes," came the reply. I pulled on the string and there was some resistance, then I saw the top arm of the L come up. "Ease off slowly," I yelled. Mabel eased off rather quicker than I expected. I had to keep tension on the string so the mechanism at the top of the roof would not catch again. However, about 3 rungs of the ladder went by me quite quickly. Good job I didn't try to grab onto them. "Sorry," came the cry from the other side of the house. "No harm done, but go much slower now please, and stop when I say so." Gradually the ladder slipped down. When the midpoint went over the edge, I yelled stop. Then I said very slowly please, so I can rotate the ladder. An inch or so each second the ladder came further. I grabbed a rung above where the rope was tied and gently pulled it so the ladder was more or less vertical. "Okay, keep going," I said, keeping a hand now on the nearest side rail of the ladder. It had only about 8 feet more to go and touched down smoothly. "Down," I yelled. A few seconds later Mabel appeared and pulled the base of the roof ladder out a bit so it was more stable. Then she steadied my ladder and I descended. "Woo," I said. "I hope we don't have to do that too often." "I couldn't have gone up there," Mabel said. "I feel a bit of a rotter letting you do it." Mabel and I suddenly realized Matilda Taylor was sitting on her raincoat on the grass at the edge of the yard. "Mother, how long have you been there?" "About a quarter of an hour, but it's not a good idea to distract people working on ladders, and Mary was doing well. I know how you hate heights, even at a remove, so I figured I'd best keep quiet." "Why don't you put on the kettle for us?" Mabel suggested, and Matilda nodded and went in the house. I said, "Well, we're done now. Let's put things away. By the way, we should put some paint or linseed oil on the ladders. I was afraid I might get some splinters there as we slid the roof ladder down." Clearing away didn't take too long. The worst job was pulling out the metal stake. We had to tap it down and side to side to loosen it, then pull it straight out of the hole it was in. "I'll see if Mother has the tea ready," Mabel said, while I was heading to the byre with the last rope. However, when I got in the kitchen and had washed my hands, I found that there was a glass each as well as a cup on the table. "Some scotch. I think you might need it after that." "I know I would," Matilda said. "Thank you, Mrs. Taylor, but get a glass yourself and we'll share this." And that's what we did. The first and only time I've had whiskey before noon. It turned out Matilda had come round to suggest that if it were feasible, she'd prefer to stay at the farm where she could be useful. She didn't know a lot about hardware and paint and tools, so she felt surplus to requirements at the ironmongery. On the other hand, she thought she might be able to cook, wash, clean, and generally look after things at the farm. I sensed Maud's hand in this, and not with any ulterior motive to get rid of her mother. Mabel said, "The bedrooms are now all spoken for unless I move Delia in with me, but I know she is so proud of her room. Perhaps we can ask her." Matilda said, "What about your front room? It's not as if you ever entertain people. The kitchen is where everything happens in this house, and truthfully it's the right place." Indeed, there were a couple of not quite armchair chairs that had cushions, as well as a half dozen chairs around the large table. It was a very large kitchen, with a good tile floor. Unfortunately, it was also the room where we put the tin tub for our baths, which could be a nuisance. There were some lines strung along the ceiling for drying laundry on a wet day. We should use them to hang some sheets for when we took a bath. The toilet for the house was outside next to the tool closet. I guess that not too long ago, there was just a privy and the kitchen didn't have running water, nor gas. Mabel had been thinking. Then she said, "Why don't we give the front room a try? Possibly move an armchair in here and bring in a cot from Maud's place. The kitchen will be a bit more crowded, but we should be able to manage. And you're right that I'd have more time for the farm work." I was near despair before Mary came. That was news to me, though it made sense now I saw how much work there was. Not that I'd complain. I'd been rather enjoying myself, despite sore muscles. Matilda said she'd talk to Maud and they'd work out getting her moved over here sometime tomorrow. Part 025. At tea, Mabel asked Oliver, "Do you remember how you and Daddy measured the farm and drew a map of it on brown wrapping paper?"
"Yes. That was 2 winters ago. Daddy said that he wanted to have all the places we grew things labeled in case we wanted to record production.
I said that's a good idea. We'd already mentioned this, but I realized Mabel wanted to involve the children." Mabel responded, "Peter thinks, the ministry will start to judge farms on their productivity. Since he left, I've been too busy to do much about it, but now you're here, we should try. If we don't know how much we produce, it won't look good and we could be told what to do, even if the orders make no sense for our soil and capabilities. For example, on our own we've no way to plow land. We do everything with just spades and sawbacks, though sometimes we do get a bit of help from Mr. Jessup's donkey, but just for a few patches." "Is the map usable?" I asked, but Oliver was already going upstairs. He came back very soon with some folded wrapping paper, much like that the shops used to pack large purchases. When he unfolded it, I realized what Mabel had in mind for the frame we'd brought down. "See how it'll fit in that frame, Oliver," she said. It would fit nicely, leaving just over a foot to spare on one side. Mabel continued, "If we put the plan on one side, there's space to list our planting on sheets pinned to the right, and probably we can record output there too, at least in summary form. That would also be a good way to think about what we should do each day," I said. "If I got up early, or you were out, I'd have an idea what to work on next, though I think I'm starting to feel my way."
"Yes. We can do that. Oliver, do you know if Daddy calculated the area of the different plots that he's numbered?"
"We did calculate the area in square yards for a few of them. I know how to do it, because Daddy drew the plan at 10 yards to the inch. He said there are 4,840 square yards per acre."
"You've a good memory," I said.
"Daddy said a good farmer knows his acres." In my mind was the chant about length measure from school. 3 feet make 1 yard, 5.5 yards make 1 rod, pole or perch, 4 rods make a chain, 10 chains make a furlong, 8 furlongs make a mile. Then we had to do the mental arithmetic to get 16.5 feet in a rod, 66 feet in a chain, 660 feet or 220 yards in a furlong, and 1,760 yards or 5,280 feet in a mile. Or we'd get a ruler across our knuckles for getting the numbers wrong. And there were the area measures. Later. "Do you know how much produce to expect from your plots?" I asked.
"Peter probably would," Mabel replied. "I sort of know the size of the pile of sacks, but that won't be good enough, though it was what started my suspicions about Joe Short. And we should see if the library can give us averages of hundredweight of crops per acre of different types so we can show, or even know, if we're efficient."
"Can I go to the library for you, Mommy?" Delia asked.
"I think that would be a very good idea, Delia.
Thank you.
I'll write down some of the ways the yield might be expressed. I think you'll have to ask the librarian to help."
In that Delia was not yet 10, I was surprised that within a couple of weeks she had managed to get several pages of figures for how much of different crops an acre of land might be expected to produce. There seemed to be several sources, and they did not always agree, nor did they always use the same units of measure. Still, we now had some sense of what to expect for the majority of the things the farm was growing. I took a few hours off a few days before Midsummer's Day and cycled into town to look for a hat. I found a men's trilby that fitted me. The brim wasn't perhaps as wide as would be ideal, but the hat fitted and looked rather sporting on me. I later found a colorful chicken feather to tuck in the ribbon. It became part of my daily uniform and kept the sun off my head and partly off my neck. While I was out, I went in W.H. Smith and asked if they had any school exercise books. Fortunately, they did, and I bought four that had ruled lines and a margin. If clothing had got scarce, so would paper. When I got home, I found a piece of string and tied a pencil to one of them. I made a hole with the tin opener of my Swiss Army knife in the spine of the exercise book so I could tie on the pencil. I labeled the book logbook in ink. There was a set of cupboards in the kitchen near where we had hung the plan of the farm, and it had a sort of counter on the bottom part, then the upper, narrower cupboards and shelves above were for crockery. I put the book on the edge of this counter. When Mabel came in, she said, "What's this?" I thought we should keep a log of what we do each day, how much we pick, sales, and so on. It might be a little untidy, but if we note the plots we work on, we should be able to figure out their productivity. And we'll be able to check when we last weeded or watered, sprayed, and so on. Matilda had seen me put the logbook on the shelf and nodded her approval. "It'll take some discipline," Mabel said. "Do you think Delia and Oliver would take charge of checking it daily and getting after us to fill things in?" "They'd probably love doing that and bossing us around a bit, on top of which Delia seems very enthusiastic about the yields, and Oliver has a lot invested in the plan, since he did it with Peter. I think he's missing his dad pretty badly, but doesn't want to show how upsetting that is for him. She probably was hiding her own cares too." Indeed, the children were enthusiastic about the log. I cautioned that we should be careful to write as tightly as we could as long as things were complete and readable. After tea, Oliver and I went to the byre and cleaned up the platform scale and the hanging scale. For the latter, Oliver showed me how to use the knob behind the clock-like face to move the pointer to zero before weighing. "Dad says that's called tearing the scale. It sounds like you're breaking it apart, but it's spelled without an E-T-A-R-I-N-G. We tried measuring a few things. The hanging scale would weigh up to 20 pounds. The platform scale went up to 1,120 pounds. 10 hundredweight. I stood on it, and found I weighed 9 stone 2 pounds. 128 pounds. That was a half stone more than I did when I lived in London. I was working a lot harder, but I suppose the good food meant I was eating more. Oh. And I did have work clothes and boots on." Oliver said, "You know there's a set of scales in the kitchen for up to 10 pounds. Mom uses them for cooking sometimes when she needs to follow a recipe, which isn't very often." "I've not seen those yet. They must be in a cupboard." "Under where we put the logbook." Part 026. A few days after our roof adventure, well, my roof adventure, there was a knock on the door just as we were having our tea. With Matilda, I'd made a sort of vegetable pie with a couple of eggs in it to bind the potato, carrot, onion, and mushroom together. I'd felt like a half hour of domesticity was in order after I'd worked since dawn picking and weeding. We'd just sat down to eat when the knock came. A woman I recognized as a neighbor, though we'd not yet been introduced, said, "I'm afraid Mrs. Ainsworth's been found dead. Doctor's there now to fill out the forms with the policeman. Thought you should know." Mabel said, "Thank you, Mrs. Foreman. Let us know if anything has to be done." However, Mabel didn't really get to finish the sentence, as Mrs. Foreman seemed intent on serving the role of the BBC in informing everyone nearby of the news, and had vanished almost like she'd evaporated into the air. Mabel returned to the table and we finished our pie, then some stewed rhubarb with a bit of suet pudding and custard. While we were eating, Mabel explained that Josephine Ainsworth was well into her 80s and lived in a modest cottage a few doors towards town. There was a daughter somewhere, but she was not a youngster, of course. As we finished the pudding, there was another knock, and I went. It turned out to be Jack, in his uniform. Of course. He was on duty and got the call to Mrs. Ainsworth. "Hello, Mary. Sorry to be a bother, but you'd likely heard courtesy of Mrs. Foreman that Mrs. Ainsworth passed away. It seems of natural causes. We're going to inform her next of kin, but there's a loose end in that she had a dog, in fact, this fellow here, whose name is Toby." There was a modest-sized terrier at the other end of a leash Jack was holding. In the same hand, he had a paper bag. When he saw me looking, Jack said, "Dog biscuits." Toby's barking alerted someone passing by. Mrs. Ainsworth had been dead some hours, and Toby needed some water and food, which I've given him. Well, water and a couple of the dog biscuits. I don't know what he's normally fed. Mabel had followed me to the door, and said, "Do you want us to look after him until Mrs. Ainsworth's daughter can come?" "That's what I was about to ask," Jack said. "It should be all right. Reggie and Toby are familiar with each other. In any event, we'll take him for a couple of days." "Thank you. I'd better get back and secure the house. Don't want any villains taking stuff. See you next Saturday, Mary. 10 o'clock suit?" "Yes, fine. See you then. Bye." Part 027. Mrs. Ainsworth's daughter came by 2 mornings later. Whether from grief or general nature, she had a sour expression and manner. Before we'd managed to say hello, she launched into, "I can't take care of a dog. Can I pay you to take him to a vet and have him put down?" Mabel gave me a glance, then said, "Yes, we can do that. With the vet's fee and getting Toby there and losing time here, shall we say £2? I stifled a gasp. I liked the little terrier. And he was quite a hunter. I'd gone to get my bike, well, Peter's bike, yesterday, and when I opened the buyer door he'd dashed in first. By the time I had the door open and could see inside, he had 3 rats killed and was lining them up for me to inspect. Now we were going to have him put to sleep. And for money. Mrs. Ainsworth's daughter, I never got her name, said a bit steep, but saves me the bother, and pulled £2 out of her handbag and quickly departed. As soon as the door was closed, Mabel said, "How about £1 each and Toby is your dog?" "You mean you aren't going to have him put down?" "Course not. He's a great little fellow, and we can probably find enough bits and bobs of rabbit along with some veg to feed both him and Reggie and the cats. Besides, he can easily earn his keep the way he gets rats. And he's hardly left your side since he got here, so I think no matter what we do, he's decided he belongs to you." "Thank you, Mabel. You had me going there. I never took you to have such a mercenary streak." "Well, I didn't like her manner. Never a bit of thanks for taking in a lost animal. No mention of her mother. So I figured we might as well get a bit of cash to help look after the little fellow. But between you, me, and the bedpost, I'd have put up a bit of a fuss before letting her do away with him." Matilda was out shopping while this occurred. She'd taken that over, and had managed to sort out her ration book with the shops. Because we had chickens, there was a special allowance for feed, but you didn't get eggs. All very tedious to record, but the rationing did ensure everyone got their share. There were lots of things not on rations, but they often weren't available. The rationed things were pretty well guaranteed unless the shop took a bomb this week, and even then a mobile canteen would usually be sent. Part 028. Saturday, June 21, 1941. My outing with Jack to Castle Neroche took place on a gorgeous day. Truly, it was Midsummer's Day. Warm and no rain. It took us a bit more than half an hour to get to the base of the castle. "But where's the castle?" I asked.
"Oh.
You mean the walls and battlements? There aren't any. Just the pattern of the structure in the ground. The Iron Age Hill Fort was a series of concentric ditches on the hill, and trees cover a good bit of that now. We'll climb up there. Let's lock up our bikes and climb up. Afraid I don't have a lock. I should get one. In fact, this is Peter's bike. I suspect the Gaffneys never ride anywhere where they leave the bicycle around where someone is likely to nick it. I'll watch for a lock for you too. But I've a good chain, so we'll put them either side of this tree and pass the chain through both frames. We did this. I'd packed some sandwiches and a bottle of lemonade in my trusty pillowcase, which I brought along. There was a fairly large square basket in front of the handlebars. A bit odd on a men's bike, but useful. Probably used for delivering small quantities of produce. But what about the Norman castle? I asked when we started walking up a woodland path. It was rather early Norman, and a motte and bailey castle. That means they built a steep little hill and put a fortified wooden structure on top. That's the motte. The bailey was an enclosed and somewhat fortified enclosure at the bottom of that small hill. However, here I think the whole thing was on top of this quite substantial hill, which has these interesting ditches like the one going off either side of us now. So there's nothing to see much of a castle, then? I asked, rather ignorantly, since the massive ditches and mounds were causing us to be out of breath. No, nothing of the structures, just the earthworks. And, of course, we'll get a great view from the top, and there's these wonderful woods. And the bluebells, I added. Where I grew up, we didn't have anything like that. Where did you grow up? Jack asked, and I'm sure it was asked innocently, but alarm bells rang in my head. I knew I had to fall back on my story, so said. After my mother and grandmother died, as I understand of the flu, some Catholic nuns took me in. It wasn't a regular orphanage, just me and another girl in a similar situation. I think the wave of deaths in 1919 had the authorities in a muddle, and the nuns, as far as I can make out, developed an affection for the two of us and never pushed for anything formal to be done. Perhaps they hoped we'd join their order, but I'm rather pleased that they didn't try to pull us in that direction. It must have been an odd childhood. I suppose, but the nuns were motherly to us. Just that there weren't many chances to see things outside the neighborhood, and even there we were kept quite protected in the convent, which was really just a large house. Here I was inventing a bit, but I had seen such a house where some Ursulines lived near where I lived with my real granny. No walks in the woods, then? I laughed. What woods? Maybe a few trees in a park, and parks were a bit rare in the neighborhood too. So bluebells are a novelty? Jack asked. Yes. I probably have only seen them once before except in pictures, and I can't remember where that was, but it was after I went out to work. Mercifully, Jack changed the subject. You seem to be enjoying the farm. That's good. The war means lots of people doing things that aren't much to their liking. I've been as happy with the Gaffneys as I've ever been. I just hope the call-up that we had to register for doesn't send me somewhere I don't like. I'd rather stay put. Doesn't the farm need your labor? Yes. But I think Mabel is worried that the War AG committee will try to let someone take over and make big fields for some crop or other. They'd be idiots to do that. That place is generating a lot of food, and for a while with just a woman and two kiddies. With you there, it should do better, and the way it's laid out, they'd have to do quite a lot of work. The Gaffneys laid out lots of paths and ditches. The ditches mean they'd have to fill in ground, and the paths that I've seen are gravel, they'd have to be dug out and they aren't wide enough to be useful for a tractor. You seem to know a lot about things like that, Jack. Couple of my uncle's farm, and I used to help out, or maybe get in the way having fun, when I was younger. My parents have a greengrocery, so I know good produce when I see it. Until I started a Victory Garden with my landlady, a lot of things were just something in the shops. As I said this, I realized Joan Smith had only been with Lavinia from 1937, and I'd no idea where she'd lived before that. Better not say too much, but start thinking of what she might have done for accommodation. "What a wonderful view," I said, seeing an opportunity to change the subject. Indeed, there was a splendid panorama from the top of the hill. We spent some time bumbling around the bumps and dips in the ground that were the vestiges of the old forts. Several times we'd come out of the trees to a new landscape laid out below us. We found a log that had been flattened on one side to serve as a bench, and I pulled out the sandwiches I'd made. Jack had a couple of bottles of cider and had some currant buns for Arters. It was a nice picnic. I'd not had such a pleasant time with a man since, well, ever. We met several groups of people walking. Most had dogs. We exchanged pleasantries and talked about the dogs and the weather. "I should have brought Toby," I said. "Are you going to keep him?" I related how Mabel had extracted £2 from Mrs. Ainsworth's daughter, at the end realizing it would reflect badly on Mabel, and might even be fraudulent. "Oh, I shouldn't have told a policeman how we got £2 under false pretenses." "Don't worry. I had a session with that lady. Don't blame Mabel at all, and Toby's a nice fellow. Good for you and Mabel, I say. You didn't take the money at knife point, and I'll bet Toby costs you a lot more than £2 over his lifetime." "True. But he may earn his keep by the way he catches rats." This led to relating how I'd learned about Toby's abilities. Jack said there were probably people who'd pay to have Toby brought round to reduce the vermin population. Possibly not pay in money, but some form of exchange of services or goods. "We could have done with someone good at fixing roof slates," I said. This led to telling about the roofing adventure, and included lots of details of how we'd done things and how I'd been the one up the ladder. Jack seemed impressed, almost worried about me. Anyway, I didn't have to talk about my past. My fictional past. And I got to talk about Matilda staying in the front room. Part 029. We came back about 3 in the afternoon and I gave Jack a cup of tea and some rhubarb cake Mabel, Matilda, and I had made the other night. Mabel joined us, and the children wolfed down a piece of cake and some orange squash then rushed off outside. Matilda was over at Maud's. Somehow I felt awkward, because it felt like I should ask Jack to stay for tea. However, there wasn't going to be enough to fill all our plates. I needn't have worried, as Jack got up and said I'd better get home to my digs. Mrs. Green feeds us pretty well given the rationing, and I've been asked to come in for a shift this evening from 6 to midnight. I walked Jack outside. "Thanks for today," I said. "It's been one of the nicest outings I've ever had." It was a pretty simple outing, but I'll agree it was very enjoyable. I hope we get to do others like it, assuming you'll put up with me. "Go on with you. And take care of yourself." Jack yelled goodbye as he mounted his bicycle and pedaled away.